Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a new study that finds there are more foreign fighters in Syria today than the total number of holy warriors who went to Afghanistan during the long war against Soviet occupation. A former senior British intelligence official, Richard Barrett, a director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company, and author of the study, joins us to discuss the concerns of blowback in Europe and elsewhere from returning jihadists back from the Syrian battlefield, as apparently was the recent case in Brussels, where an attack on a Jewish museum carried out by a member of ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, killed three people. Then we'll be joined by Matthew Ho, a former Marine Corps company commander who served in Iraq and Afghanistan and was the former director of the Afghanistan Study Group at the State Department and the Pentagon. We'll discuss the upcoming ribbon-cutting ceremony on June the 6th, D-Day, where Matthew Ho will be launching a billboard across the street from the State Department displaying a picture of Daniel Ellsberg with a quote from the Vietnam-era whistleblower urging today's whistleblowers to come forward to, quote, save a war's worth of lives. We will also discuss the shameful Republican-orchestrated attacks on an American POW that the press is dutifully parroting. Then finally, we will speak with Washington Post columnist and best-selling author David Ignatius, who has covered the Middle East and the CIA for 25 years, about his new book, The Director. We will explore the world of cyber espionage and the roles of key players like Edward Snowden and Julian Assange, who are forcing the CIA to relearn the basics so that the CIA can operate in a new world where security is never guaranteed for long, as advancement in technology constantly levels the playing field. Joining us now is Richard Barrett, a director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He's also senior director for special projects at the Qatar International Academy of Security Studies in Doha and sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center of Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington. From March 2004 to December 2012, he was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban Monitoring Group at the United Nations in New York, appointed by the UN Secretary General. And in 2005, Richard helped establish a system-wide United Nations Working Group on Terrorism, which became the United Nations Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Barrett.
Thank you very much.
And the study that you've just produced at the Sufan Group on the number of foreign fighters in Syria, I take it that the number has exceeded the number of all of those holy warriors that went to Afghanistan during the long war with the Soviet Union.
Well, that's right. Of course, the numbers are not very exact, and the best guess of people who went to Afghanistan, probably around 10,000, but it could be much lower than that. It could even be higher than that. But the fact of the matter is that in Syria, there is almost certainly more people gone in the 3 years since that conflict began than in the whole period from 1979, when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, to 2001 and the fall of the Taliban. So it is pretty significant.
Well, we all know about the blowback from Afghanistan, bin Laden being kind of the poster boy for that. What sort of blowback? Well, so far there's been this incident at the Jewish Museum in Brussels where a member of ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, apparently killed three people. Do you see that as the beginning of a trend?
Well, that guy certainly was in Syria fighting with one of the extremist groups. He was radicalized probably before he went to Syria, and he may have been quite disturbed. But the fact of the matter is that his experiences in Syria will not have been in any way dissuasive of such action, and it may well have encouraged it. And so I think that that is something that we're going to see more, these individuals who are coming back and doing something not necessarily at the direction of the group they joined in Syria, but nonetheless very much within the sort of way of thinking of those groups.
But I take it that what concerns Western authorities more are the Westerners in the group, like the American who apparently blew himself up recently, who came from southern Florida, the idea being that Americans are easy, they're not profiled so much at airports, Europeans.
Well, yes, indeed. And that guy, you know, having led a very ordinary life until that point and apparently gone over to just help with humanitarian assistance for Syria, turns out to be a suicide bomber. It's a trajectory that is hard to predict. And so had he come back, he would have resumed his life, I presume, normally with his friends and family and so on. But who knows what sort of radicalizing influences might have remained within him and what he might have done in the future, because the whole experience of fighting with one of these extremist groups, or even fighting in a war full stop, of course, is pretty traumatizing as well as radicalizing. To blow yourself up like that in a suicide bombing is hardly normal behavior, of course.
So of the 12,000 foreign fighters now in Syria, what percentage of them would be from the West?
Well, I reckon about a quarter, so about 25%. And I think the significance here is that those guys who've gone, most of those 3,000, have joined the most extreme groups that are operating in Syria. And it's not as though they didn't know those groups were operating there before they went, and they may even have gone and tried to join them deliberately. So that, to me, says, you know, asks quite a few questions. You know, what was your real reason for going? Okay, it may have been just to join in the fight and try and protect the community from the aggression of the Assad regime and so on. But nonetheless, you know before you go that those al-Qaeda-related groups have an agenda that's beyond Syria. So it sort of immediately raises some questions.
So a quarter of 12,000 is 3,000, and it wouldn't take a very, it'd only take a very small percentage of 3,000 people to cause havoc in the West, wouldn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, let's assume that the great majority of them are going there. They will either stay there, maybe they'll die there, maybe they'll get disillusioned or disgusted by what they see and come back, or maybe they'll just get fed up or feel that they've done their thing and want to return to their friends and family in their normal life. And they may not be a threat. But it doesn't take many, as you say, to cause a problem. We had the Tsarnaev brothers, for example, in the Boston Marathon. There's only two of them, it seems, who caused all that havoc. And individuals, too, you know, like Nidal Hassan, for example, at Fort Hood, and these other incidents of terrorism. And even the 9/11 hijackers, of course, there weren't that many of them either in comparison to 3,000. So altogether, although it's not proved that there's going to be a connection between people going to Syria to fight and coming back to mount a terrorist attack, the worry must be there that even 1 or 2% would be a significant problem.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Barrett, the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He's also senior director for special projects at the Qatar International Academy for Security Studies in Doha and sits on the board of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center for Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington, D.C., and he was coordinator of the al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations in New York, appointed by the UN Secretary General. And in 2005, he helped establish a system-wide United Nations Working Group on Terrorism, which became the United Nations Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force. So let's turn to the real broader and more important issue, I guess, and that is, what kind of policy do we have towards Syria? It became very apparent with the fact that Robert Ford, the career diplomat and Arabic speaker, who was up until recently the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Syria, he went on PBS NewsHour and basically said he quit his post in February because the policy had failed and he could no longer defend it. And so, you know, we've had people like Secretary of State Hillary Clinton saying that Assad's days are numbers and he'll be out of there soon. And for the longest time, it seems like we have the worst of both worlds. We have this premature elation and predictions of his downfall, and now he's rubbing it in our face with obviously a bogus election, but nevertheless, he looks like he's there to stay. And as Ford, Ambassador Ford says, the war could go on for years. So my question to you would be, you know, in contrast to the Russians and the Iranians, who know exactly what they want and have supported Assad to the hilt, why is it that on the Western side they don't seem to know what they want?
Well, I guess what they want is for Assad suddenly to sort of disappear, not just Assad, but the whole regime that holds him up and he represents. But as you say, it's not going to happen. And already in 3 years of war, we can see that neither side is going to win if it's just a question of battling. But so there has to be something else. And I think that the key, probably, is the engagement of the international community, that if the United States and Russia, if Saudi Arabia and Iran, you know, they're all on very much opposing sides, but if they could get together and say, look, this is ridiculous, Syria is being destroyed, social cohesion is going out the window. A country that was relatively stable and relatively secular and relatively moderate in its views, even if you didn't like all its views, is now becoming riven by sectarianism and ethnic divides and so on. And we need to stop that because it's going to destabilize the whole Middle East. And then you might see the major powers getting together and saying, okay, we're going to stop supporting the rebel side, we're going to stop supporting Assad's side, and they got to understand that they need to come together to sort something out. But right now, it's difficult to see how we're going to achieve that. And I think the policy options, particularly for the West, as you say, in Syria, are really rather limited. You know, you're damned whatever you do. And I wouldn't know what to suggest, really, beyond trying to stop the war by all means at the international level.
Well, it seems that Ambassador Ford is saying that we've consistently been behind the curve, and he's saying we need to help the moderate Syrian opposition. But is that a case where, at the time when everybody was predicting Assad's exit, that was the time to help before the jihadis and the radicals got in there? And clearly they've been a gift to Assad. They have changed the subject.
They really have been a gift to Assad. Yes, I agree with that. And I think now, what does it mean to help the moderates? What are you going to do to help the moderates? There's been a great hesitation in this country not to supply, for example, surface-to-air missiles and things that, if they fell into the wrong hands, could be extremely dangerous beyond Syria. And so there's been a bit of training, there's been a bit of supply of less sophisticated weaponry and so on, now even anti-tank rockets. But who are the moderates, you know? And even if you do help the moderates, what's that going to mean? Are they going to be able to beat up the extremists as well as to beat up the government forces and then impose some other form of repressive government? Well, that's not a particularly good result either. So there has to be something that really engages all Syrians but leaves out either extreme, you know, the bits of the regime which are extremely unpleasant and the bits of the rebel movement which are extremely unpleasant.
Well, it sounds like the only solution, as you mentioned earlier, Richard Barrett, is for Russia and America and Saudi Arabia and Iran to get together. The latter is highly unlikely. And given the problems with Ukraine, it's equally unlikely, it would seem, that there's going to be much cooperation between Russia and the United States. So is that where we're at? I mean, in other words, we're hoping that a moral kind of influx, if you will, into realpolitik here will change the equation. Otherwise, it's deeply cynical.
Well, you're right. There's a huge humanitarian problem now with almost half the population of 23 million. So that's about 10, 11 million displaced from their homes by the fighting and deeply affected by it. That's a huge, huge problem for the region as well as for the future of Syria. And clearly that humanitarian problem and the whole reconstruction issues of Syria have got to be dealt with by the international community. And I don't think anyone wants the thing to get worse. I don't think that Russia or United States or Saudi Arabia or Iran, for that matter, want to see more people dying and more people suffering and so on from this war. And so eventually maybe they'll see their political interests coincide with their more sort of humanitarian interests, if you like, in trying to move towards a solution. But as you say, there are various other factors going on in the world which make that rather difficult at present. I think there has been changes of policy within the region, particularly you can see it perhaps in Saudi Arabia and perhaps even in Iran to a certain extent, but they are yet to translate into some sort of discussion about the future.
Well, you mean the Saudis have had second thoughts about all those jihadis flocking to Syria, and now they've, in fact, banned it, right, as opposed to encouraging it, which they've done in the past with the Taliban and in Pakistan. So do you think the Saudis really have had a change of heart?
Well, exactly. I think they have seen that this now has got out of hand and that their policy of supporting the extremist groups and hoping that they would have a quick victory, well, that hasn't worked out too well. So now they're facing the enormous problems of blowback, which may hit them sooner rather than later. You know, they got probably well over 2,000, maybe 2,500 people fighting there in Syria. And that's a sizable number of people if they start coming back to Saudi Arabia. On the Iranian side, it's a little bit more difficult to say, but of course Hezbollah has been very much involved as a result of Iranian direction, and now very many of the Shia militia in Iraq are involved as well. And I think it seems, I don't quite know how to interpret it, but it seems that Iran is suggesting the Hezbollah pull out, rather, and that the Iraqi Shia sort of take their place. And I think that's a slight stepping down. It's a slight saying, okay, let's not involve the big regional powers like Hezbollah. Let's just do it on a more minor scale. We have perhaps more control and we can shut off the valve more easily. But perhaps that's being optimistic.
Well, certainly Hezbollah's involvement has not been popular in Lebanon. There may be that factor as well.
Well, indeed, yes. Hezbollah has... Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, is an extremely clever politician, of course, and I think he's managed to sort of thread the eye of the needle there pretty well. But nonetheless, you're right, the involvement of Hezbollah has led to sectarian attacks within Lebanon. It's led to Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS establishing branches there. We've had bombings in Shia areas south of Beirut and so on. So it's not a good situation for Hezbollah either.
Well, Richard Barrett, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He is also senior director for special projects at the Qatar International Academy for Security Studies in Doha and sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington. From March 2004 to December 2012, he was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations in New York, appointed by UN Secretary General. And in 2005, he helped establish a system-wide United Nations Working Group on Terrorism, which became the United Nations Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a Marine Corps veteran from Afghanistan, Matthew Ho. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Matthew Ho, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a former director of the Afghanistan Study Group. A former Marine and State Department official, he resigned in protest from his post in Afghanistan over U.S. strategic policy and goals in Afghanistan. Previously, he served in Iraq, first with the State Department Reconstruction and Governance Team, and then in 2006 as a Marine Corps company commander. He worked on Afghanistan and Iraq policy and operations issues at the Pentagon and State Department from 2002 to 2008. And in 2010, Matthew was named the Ridenhour Prize recipient for truth-telling. He is a member of the Board of Directors of the Council for a Livable World and an advisor to the Board of Directors of ExposeFacts.org, a new organization. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Ho.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And Matthew, in response to the Secretary of State John Kerry's remarks recently, where he invoked the Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg while denouncing the NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, a billboard will be put up right across from the State Department. The opening ceremony is Friday, June 6, D-Day, and you, along with a former State Department diplomat and retired Army Colonel Anne Wright, will have the honor of cutting the ribbon, announcing the billboard, which I'm sure will be pretty evident. So tell me about the billboard and the ceremony and the organization that's behind this, this new organization, ExposeFacts.org.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, Ian, and thanks again for having me on, it's called Expose Facts, and the website is exposefacts.org. There are about 40 former government officials, military officers, whistleblowers who serve on the advisory board for Exposed Facts, as well as either five or six members of the editorial board, so journalists who have the they're the ones who are going to be overseeing Exposed Facts operation. And the purpose behind Exposed Facts is to encourage others to speak out, to get people who are, whether they're in government or in private industry, who are seeing wrongdoing, who are seeing things that are criminal or corrupt or hazard to the public, to get them to come forward, to help them come forward and speak their mind and do the right thing and try and correct the wrongs they are seeing. So we have a website. Again, it's exposedfacts.org. If your listeners go there, they'll see some basic information on Exposed Facts, as well as to what is called a secure drop. And that is software provided by the Freedom of the Press Foundation. And this allows someone who wants to report something, who wants to blow the whistle on the activity, again, whether it's in the government or in private industry, to anonymously and securely provide an information to our editorial board, who will then advise and assist that person in coming forward. And we are we have a relationship with a number of journalistic outfits. We're actually a journalistic outfit ourselves. So the idea would be that, again, to assist and encourage others to come forward. I should mention that this is a project of the Institute for Public Accuracy. And as part of this project, we are placing billboards. And the first billboard we are placing is right outside the State Department in Washington, D.C. And as you said, Ian, it is of Daniel Ellsberg. And if you're not familiar with Daniel Ellsberg, I really encourage you to just Google him real quickly, read about him on Wikipedia. If you have an hour and a half to spend, the documentary that came out on Dan a few years ago was nominated for Academy Awards, called The Most Dangerous Man in the World. Take an hour and a half of your time to watch that. But Daniel Ellsberg was a Marine, then he was a career Defense Department official, worked for a long time under Secretary McNamara, served a number of different presidents, but was heavily involved in the Vietnam War. And then finally, his conscience broke, and he published the Pentagon Papers. And the Pentagon Papers revealed that the United States government had known for a long time that the war in Vietnam was not working, that we were losing, and that what we are claiming to be the purposes and the causes of the war were not correct, that we are supporting a corrupt government there, and everyone knew it, and this really wasn't an issue about freedom and democracy. It was an issue of a civil war within a host country. So that's what Daniel Ellsberg is famous for. He was put on trial. He was found not guilty. And then, of course, at one point, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger described him as the most dangerous man in the world, hence the title. But pull ahead to 40 years later, and we have Dan on a billboard outside the State Department. And again, the purpose is to encourage people to come forward, people who see wrongdoing, people who see that our current wars are not just or not sound, that we have not won those wars despite all the best rhetoric of the Bush and the Obama administration, and that these wars are claiming countless lives, many of them voiceless, nameless people overseas, but also, too, a lot of Americans here at home, a lot of American families have suffered for wars that haven't accomplished anything and haven't served to make America safer. But if I can, Ian, what I'd like to do is just read the quote that we have on the billboard from Daniel Ellsberg.
Right, and the billboard features a photo of Daniel Ellsberg, doesn't it, with this quote?
Yes, it does.
Okay, go ahead with the quote.
Okay, and the billboard says, it's quote from Daniel Ellsberg, and it says, "Don't do what I did. Don't wait until a new war has started. Don't wait until thousands more have died before you tell the truth with documents that reveal lies or crimes or internal projections of costs and dangers. You might save a war's worth of lives."
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Ho, who is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and the former director of the Afghanistan Study Group, a former Marine and State Department official. He resigned in protest from his post in Afghanistan over U.S. strategic policy and goals in Afghanistan, and previously served in Iraq first with the State Department Reconstruction and Governance Team, and then in 2006 as a Marine Corps company commander. He worked on Afghanistan and Iraq policy and operations issues at the Pentagon and State Department from 2002 to 2008. And in 2010, Matthew was named the Rittenhouse Prize recipient for truth-telling. He is a member of the board of directors for the Council for a Livable World and is on the advisory board of ExposeFacts.org, a new organization. And on Friday, D-Day, in front of the Pentagon, Matthew, along with Colonel Anne Wright, will be cutting a ribbon, inaugurating the billboard that's literally across the street from the State Department, a billboard with a picture of Daniel Ellsberg that says, "Don't do what I did. Don't wait until a new war has started. Don't wait until thousands more have died before you tell the truth with documents that reveal lies or crimes or internal projections of costs and dangers. You might save a war's worth of lies." And talking about lies, I'm not sure about the extent to which we're being lied about this current scandal involving the Sergeant Bergdahl, who was swapped for five Taliban prisoners. But I find it very troubling, Matthew Ho, and you're a veteran from Afghanistan, the idea that Republican political operatives are bringing forth people from Bergdahl's unit that are criticizing him, and the press literally are acting as stenographers for Republican operatives. What's your feeling about this ginned-up scandal?
Yeah, I actually have been friends with Bob and Jenny Bergdahl for about a year and a half, 2 years now. They're the parents of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. And so I'm, of course, very sympathetic to the family, and I'm, frankly amazed and stupefied at the disgusting tactics being used by members of our political system, members of the press, as well as just members of the general public. Rather than celebrating and rejoicing the fact that a family's suffering is now over, that the Bergdahls are getting their son back, who had been held captive by the Taliban for 5 years. We are set on demonizing him, demonizing them, and basically trying to destroy them. And it is a sickening and gross and distasteful display of partisanship. It's crazy, and you always think you see. You always think it can't get worse, right? And then you see this, and you're like, "Wow, this is just ridiculous." And then, of course, I understand and I sympathize with the feelings and the angers and the frustration of those who so served with Bo. And if it turns out true that he did walk away from his post, and I can understand why they're angry with him, but. One, they're being used for political purposes, as you very aptly described. And as soon as this has shifted and they've moved on to something else to attack the Obama administration on, and people who know me know I'm not a huge Obama administration supporter, right? But as soon as don't think I'm coming from a partisan position on this either. As soon as they're done with using these soldiers to attack the president, they're going to discard them, and they're going to leave those kids to be, even though they've stirred up this hornet's nest. But what I would say to these guys, to these soldiers, is hey, I understand your grief. I understand your anger. But that should be directed not at Bo, not at your brother who was confused and walked away. You should have compassion for him, compassion for his family. But rather, why are you not angry at those generals who continued this war, those generals who spoke about how well the war was going, those generals who sold to the American public that it was a necessary war? Why are you not angry at the politicians who have continued these wars, who have lied to you about these wars? They're the ones responsible for all these deaths in these wars. It's not 27-year-old Bo Bergdahl and his actions 5 years ago when he was 22-year-old that we should be seeking his head and seeking his family's blood, but rather, why are we not holding accountable those who are actually responsible for the wars and those who are actually responsible for these deaths and these mistakes.
Well, one of the aspects of it that I find particularly troubling is that my understanding, Matthew Ho, is that after Bo Bogdol's disappearance and capture by the Taliban, the military and the CIA did an extremely exhaustive investigation. Apparently, it's very, very thorough. And the results of that haven't been released. But, you know, the idea that people are jumping the gun, particularly in the press, about what happened there when we don't really know whether he was AWOL. He apparently had contacts with villagers before and had left without his weapon, et cetera, and body armor. And it's quite possible that he was meeting with people and was captured. So the assumption that he's a traitor and a deserter, and also the ugliness of going after the parents because they simply don't look like in a typical photo opportunity as the all-American military family. I just think this is a new low for American politics.
It really is, and particularly, too, you know, if you've, you know, again, I actually had dinner with Bob and Jannie 2 days before it was announced that their son was being released. And you know, Bob has the beard, and he wears the black outfit and everything. And, you know, what he does that for, and he's learning Pashto, and he's learning Urdu, and he's immersed himself in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And he's done that because I assume like every other parent would do. His son was held captive for 5 years. He wanted to know everything about his son. He wanted to know everything about what his son was going through. Remember, I was talking with him via Skype, I don't know how long ago, a year or so ago maybe, and an alarm went off in his house. And he said he apologized, sorry about that. And he said what the alarm was he had set alarms in his house to go off for, you know, basically Western Pakistan, Eastern Afghanistan time, corresponding with the Muslim calls for prayer. And he did this because he realized that because, you know, Bo was being held by the Taliban, Bo was probably being roused and made to pray with them 5 times a day. And he did that because he wanted to know what his son was doing. He wanted to try and understand what his son was going through. And so, yeah, just the lack of compassion, the lack of empathy, really, like as you said, you know, it's reached a low point in this country. And it really is just truly disgusting and really absurd. And, of course, the journalistic standards on this are just appalling. I mean, it's just they'll print or they'll say anything that will try and get them more clicks or you know, more ratings. And, yeah, and that's the fact. Even if it is all true and he left, you know, that the base walked away because he wanted to quit the war, he was held captive by the Taliban for 5 years. I mean, why do we need to punish this young man any more than that? It's just absurd. It's just insane. But the bloodlust over this, and I have no other way to describe it, but the bloodlust over it is really, really quite sickening.
And it's not just the right-wing press, even though these soldiers that have been criticizing Bergdahl from his unit were brought forth to the and handed to the media on a plate by Republican operatives. People like Chris Matthews have gone to town on him and blackened him without really knowing the facts. And surely it's in the hands
absolutely.
Of the military, isn't it? They're going to look into this. They've already done an exhaustive study. I imagine the White House knew about this report. And their position is that you don't leave a soldier behind on a battlefield. From your point of view, being a veteran, Matthew Ho, isn't that important to the men and women in the war zone in Afghanistan to know that their government has their back?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, 3 years ago, the Israelis traded over 1,000 prisoners for one of their soldiers. This is what is done. Most of the comments about this, with the exception of Senator John McCain, most of the comments about this are coming from men and women who've never served a day in uniform. You do not leave people behind. Any soldier is brought back. That's just what, and I know we left people behind in Vietnam, never accounted for. There are thousands we never accounted for in Korea, and that's a black mark on our country and on our military. I saw comments today from Senator Lindsey Graham, who said that even if he was a Medal of Honor winner, we shouldn't have traded five. I mean, it's just astounding what is being said, and all for political purposes, all just to attack the administration. And again, I am not, you know, I'm not a big, you know, supporter of this administration, you know, but on this, I really have to, you know, offer thanks, you know, to the president, to his team, to Secretary Hagel and Secretary Kerry, you know, for doing this, for taking the political risk and bringing back Bob and Janie's son, I mean, it just, it means so much to me. And of course, you can't even begin to understand what it means to them, right? So I am. I'm very appreciative of the president taking this political risk and doing what was the right thing.
Well, Matthew Ho, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate it. You have a good day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Ho, who is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and the former director of the Afghanistan Study Group. A former Marine and State Department official, he resigned in protest from his post in Afghanistan over U.S. strategic policy and goals in Afghanistan, and previously served in Iraq, first as a State Department Reconstruction and Governance Team, and then in 2006 as a Marine Corps company commander. He worked on Afghanistan and Iraq policy and operations issues at the Pentagon and State Department from 2002 to 2008, and in 2010, Matthew was named the Ridenour Prize recipient for truth-telling. He is a member of the Board of Directors of the Council for a Livable World, and is on the advisory board of the new organization exposefacts.org. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with Washington Post columnist and best-selling author David Ignatius.
That you find a pretty face can hide an evil mind. Oh, be careful what you say, or you'll give yourself away. Odds are you won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Asian man, secret Asian.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Ignatius, who is a prize-winning columnist for The Washington Post, who has been covering the Middle East and the CIA for more than 25 years. He's the best-selling author of Body of Lies, The Increment, Blood Money, and his latest book just out is The Director. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Ignatius.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
And this whole kind of netherworld of hacking, cyber warfare, is both on a state level with the Russians, the FSB, and the Chinese, with that unit that the New York Times has exposed, actively involved. And, of course, you know, the U.S. recently named a group of PLA officers in a kind of with a wanted poster, if you will. But there's also this other world of anarchists and hackers and anonymous. So how do you distinguish? I know your novel delves into these worlds between the world of professional spies and the world of these sort of anarchist hackers.
What I say in The Director, drawing on my research and what I believe has happened to some extent in real life, is that these worlds have merged. One thing I discovered was that the market for what hackers call zero-day exploits, which are the little gaps, holes in software and operating system into which you can insert malware and attack your adversary, are bought and sold in a market in which governments are players just as criminal underground groups are. So in the novel, my characters talk about how this is all becoming one world, and from an intelligence counter-espionage standpoint, it must be fascinating to try to figure out who among these nominal hackers is just that, is a independent, libertarian-minded person, and who is actually traveling under that flag as an agent of a foreign intelligence service.
Well, of course, this is very much in the political zeitgeist, if you will, because of these characters like Julian Assange and Edward Snowden. And there's no question that, I don't know whether you saw John Kerry's outburst the other day, but he obviously is pretty steamed up about what he considers to be damage done by Snowden. But if you kind of add up the bill, which is certainly not entirely clear, but I spoke with some people at the New America Foundation who've just done a study on the financial costs of the Snowden revelations, and it's something like $180 billion over the next 3 or 5 years to the American computing cloud industry. They took a full-page ad in Thursday's New York Times, all of the big Silicon Valley barons, the Facebook head and all of those people who've visited the White House and lobbied pretty strenuously. So that's one set of costs. The other one is how much it cost us in the first place to give the NSA all those capabilities. And the third cost would be that the NSA are going to now turn to the taxpayer and say, because of Edward Snowden, we've got to start from scratch and it's going to cost you X billions of dollars again. So do you see that as being an amazing bill?
Well, the bill will be substantial on many different levels. The question is whether the benefits to the public in terms of public awareness of these programs, reforms that are made, is worth it. I should just say that because there's a lot of speculation, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, has speculated publicly on television that Edward Snowden may have been recruited by the Russians, used by the Russians. I have asked U.S. government officials repeatedly over the last year if there's evidence to support that, and I've been told as recently as this week that the answer is no, that there is no solid evidence. And I just want to say that to caution people. This is one of those subjects on which there's an awful lot of speculation. It's the kind of thing that a spy novelist loves to think about, but people need to be very careful here not to confuse fact and fiction.
Well, indeed, the full-page ad in the New York Times from the Silicon Valley giants basically is urging the United States Senate to come up with a stronger bill than the USA Freedom Act that was passed by the House that was considerably watered down, apparently by lobbying from the intelligence community. So where do you think we stand in terms of public outrage and what will be done to fix what Snowden's revealed in terms of...
I can only assume, Ian, that the public is trying to balance the same two things that the Congress is. On the one hand, in light of what Snowden revealed, I think many people feel that NSA surveillance has been beyond what's appropriate in a democracy and would like to see it changed or scaled back. And the congressional bill does that. It moves the keeping of metadata to the phone companies from the NSA. It reduces the time itself probably from 5 years to 1 to 2 years. At the same time, I think people wouldn't want to be in a situation where the intelligence agencies were unable to follow up. Let's say they captured somebody who'd been calling the United States. They'd want to know who that person was calling. And so somehow we want to come up with a system that works to do those two things, protect civil liberties to the extent possible and also protects the security of the country. Whether the bill that looks like it's going to be passed does that, whether it goes far enough, too far, I have a feeling we're just going to have to experiment with it. If after 2 or 3 years, there are no great threats to the United States, we're capable of dealing with concerns about terrorists overseas and assure a lot of new al-Qaeda recruits in Syria and Iraq, then I would think people would say, well, let's go further. Let's have additional reforms. Let's take additional kind of steps that some of these companies are requesting. I think when you think about the big American cloud service providers and other tech companies that are getting pounded overseas, that are losing business, the initial estimates that I printed were $25 billion to $35 billion, but now people are saying it's likely to be much more. It's understandable why they would say we want to see, you know, stronger reforms, greater reforms, more transparency, less surveillance. And, you know, they have to convince their clients around the world that they're not just American companies, that they're not part of a global dragnet to take people's information. So that's understandable. That doesn't mean just because tech companies are advocating it that that's the right policy. It's certainly true that the bill that's before Congress that the president appears willing to sign will move the country significantly from where it was, and that's a good thing.
Again, I'm speaking with David Ignatius, who is the prize-winning columnist for The Washington Post, who has covered the Middle East and the CIA for more than 25 years, and he's the best-selling author of Body of Lies, The Increment, Blood Money, and his latest book just out is The Director. And the director, of course, refers to the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, your main character, the other character being, I guess, a walk-in, right, is what they call in the intelligence world.
Well, the other main character really is the chief technical wizard of the CIA, person who heads its Information Operations Center, named James Morris, who my director, Graham Weber, has met and turns to in the crisis that's caused when this walk-in stumbles into the American consulate in Hamburg, Germany, and says to the CIA base chief there, "You've been hacked. We're inside your computers, and here is proof, is a list of the names of your officers in Switzerland and Germany." At that point, the ultimate existential crisis for an intelligence agency, the new director, Graham Weber, turns to James Morris and asks him for help. And the novel's really a story of all of the difficulty that ensues for the director from that moment on.
But doesn't the CIA in the real world have a real dilemma that they have all these firewalls to protect the information within their building, and particularly the director of operations? They're incredibly hermetically sealed from the outside world. At the same time, the internet itself is so open, and you really need to understand that world. You can't wall yourself up from it. So is that a real conflict and a problem that the CIA has?
Well, my novel, The Director, is really about the collision of those two worlds. The CIA and other intelligence agencies do try to seal themselves off. They talk about having an air gap. In other words, no connectivity to what they call the dirty wire of the internet. The way in which people can send messages, send malware, disrupt communications. So their great fear is that someone would get inside the air gap, would get inside their bubble, and be able to manipulate their technology, their software. And that's really what happens in this novel. The novel's the story of somebody getting inside the air gap. In terms of finding out what's going on in the real world of hackers, the real world of cyber espionage, I think the CIA and the NSA, as we've discovered through Snowden, have been pretty aggressive in going after that. Just one small example, when I was doing research for this novel, I went to the big convention of hackers that's held every summer in Las Vegas. It's called DEF CON. We're now up to DEF CON 22. And for years, the CIA, NSA, other agencies have been using that as a recruiting ground to spot the smartest young hackers, see what they're doing, see what new techniques they're coming up with, hiring the very best of them if they can, but certainly informing themselves about what's coming at them, what's hot in this market. There's a world that your listeners may have stumbled across that's sometimes referred to as the dark web, where a lot of the super secret, often illegal hacking activity goes on. Again, that's space in which our intelligence agencies have wanted to enter so that they can see what's going on, but also so that they can hire the smartest people and try to turn them into patriots. Personally, I think that's part of what got the NSA into so much trouble. You combined a sort of hacker ethos. If you can crack it, go after it, with the unregulated secret bureaucracy of the NSA, huge bureaucracy, not subject to the normal management controls, and a combination of the two was really, really poisonous.
Well, there's no question that there may well be a little hypocrisy here if we're accusing the Chinese of having legions of hackers. That the playing field is a little more level from what you're telling us, right? When the U.S. is not exactly sitting back on their thumbs.
I think it's fair to say the U.S. has not been passive in trying to exploit its advantages, its first mover advantages, being the place where this technology originated. One of the Chinese generals said after our latest accusations were members of the PLA, People's Liberation Army, were actually indicted, said, you know, it's always the thief who shouts, "Stop, thief!" And, you know, that was their way of saying that we were being hypocritical about this. And I think the distinction that American officials would draw is between the kind of cyber espionage that the U.S. doesn't acknowledge, but clearly it does, and what the American officials have claimed in this indictment is a deliberate Chinese government attempt to steal intellectual property, to steal the most valuable secrets of American companies, both operating in China and operating here. So companies like Boeing, like Microsoft, go down the list of American companies with important, valuable technology. The allegation is that those secrets of immense value have been stolen.
So, David Ignatius, in doing the research for your new book, The Director, this world of anarchy and hacking, and it's transnational, like most of the threats today. I understand from talking to people that deal with cybersecurity that organized crime has gravitated to the internet because they simply can make so much money without the possibility of being killed. And, you know, so it's a hell of a deal for them. How would you quantify this world of the merging between hackers and intelligence people in that context of how much organized crime has stolen the march on the internet?
Well, from what I read and from conversations I have with people who were in this world, I think it is true that organized crime, especially criminal groups located in Eastern Europe and Russia, have been very aggressive. One example are the, in a sense, simple in terms of the software involved, denial of service attacks. Just harness enough computers, link them up, and you can barrage a server with so many queries that the server basically can't handle them and shuts down. Well, if you're in a business, you know, like let's say you're doing online betting or online poker, anything online, you need to be up or you're going to go out of business. And so you can set up fairly simply an extortion ring where you say, we're going to bombard you with the denial of service traffic and shut you down until you pay us enough to allow you to stay open. And there are, in the literature, lots of examples of this being done. And the truth is, companies especially just have to stay open at key times, pay the money.
Well, in terms of back to the Snowden and Assange characters in the real world, isn't there a real possibility that at some point or other, in terms of the gray area of intelligence, the white being the analysis, black being covert operations, and the gray, you know, psyops and propaganda, etc. I would think that if you could get an Assange, and many people have accused Assange of being involved with the FSB, the Russian intelligence people, if you could get an Assange working for you, that would be a great way to disseminate propaganda, would it not?
I can't speak to the Assange case because I just haven't done the research, but I have thought about this current period in which you have around the world a connected generation, people who feel a libertarian impulse about their mail, their social networks, their connections with people online, and what a fertile feeding ground that is for clever intelligence officers. And I liken it in my novel to the situation that existed in the 1930s when the Russians, who really are the world's sublime spy masters, recruited the spy network that's known as the Cambridge Five, going after very idealistic young students who felt the world was at a crossroads, who felt that you had to make this choice for freedom, for to break from the Nazis, to break from the right-wing movements that were sweeping across Europe. And the Soviet intelligence service at the time just did an incredible job in recruiting agents. Some of them, like Tim Philby, lasted their whole lifetime. They were so intensely motivated in that period. Given how good the Russians are at this, it would be surprising to me if they weren't out in this terrain recruiting with subtlety, probably recruiting under false flags. They've been good at that historically. One thing the Russian intelligence service in every period has been good at is penetrating opposition groups. I mean, if there was a Latvian or Polish Georgian opposition group, often it turned out it was almost entirely controlled by Russian agents who'd penetrated and taken it over in secret. So, you know, this is a very adept and determined adversary. You know, looking at these pictures of Snowden sitting in Moscow, you just wonder what kind of pressures he's up against, what kind of subtle tools have been used against him. We won't know about any of that, I assume, until he's able to come home one way or another.
Well, just in closing, David Ignatius, your director in your new book, The Director, the head of the CIA, obviously he's up to the task, particularly his tech guy. But do you think our current office holder is up to the task?
John Brennan is a career intelligence officer. He is not a technician. He's an analyst. I think the question really is, is he creating a work environment in which smart young people want to work? And is he pulling the CIA out of the past into the future? One of the themes of my novel is the CIA is a place that really is haunted by the ghosts of its own history. And if John Brennan is smart, he'll find a way to pull the agency into the present, to you know, find and use the smartest young people he can. And then finally, he'll find a way to make sure that the agency feels both to its employees and to the American public like a real part of America. That's really a, kind of the abiding theme of this novel, is that the CIA will be successful to the extent that it's perceived as American and consistent with the country's values, to the extent that it's seen as lawless, arrogant, elitist, chained to the remnants of a kind of European colonial system. It will fail, much as it has for too many of the past decades.
Well, given what's just happened with Snowden, the NSA certainly has got a lot of work to do, and I assume the CIA has too, to win back the public trust. And I thank you for joining us, David Ignatius.
Thanks. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David Ignatius, who's a prize-winning columnist for The Washington Post, who's been covering the Middle East and the CIA for more than 25 years. He's the best-selling author of Body of Lies, The Increment, Blood Money, and his latest book just out is The Director. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.